Welcome to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, founder and executive director of At the Epicenter. And with me today is Daniela Ibarra-Howell, co-founder and CEO of Savory Institute. We're doing this a little differently. We're actually in a room together in Boulder, Colorado. And it's a deep pleasure for me to have Daniela here. We are friends and allies in our work to really bring transformation to our planet through the power of healing the land. Savory, for those of you who are not familiar, is an international network of hubs around the world that are really, you know, ranchers teaching ranchers how to do holistic land management with their animals, being part of a deep healing matrix for grasslands and also improving the lives of the producers and their communities.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, there's so many things that we could dive into. Mm-hmm. And I think what's attracting me is what I said in the intro about the land. The land is something we all share in common around the world. And we humans have been misguided in a lot of the ways that we've interfaced with the living ecosystems around us. And we have now come to a point in our human history that there's a bit of a reckoning. Mm-hmm. And with that reckoning comes opportunity.
Yes.
And that's what I want us to lean into. I think there's a lot of clarity for a lot of folks that we're in a bit of a mess. But there are pathways that lead us to much better outcomes.
Yes.
And you have such beautiful ways of articulating what those pathways are towards this new way of relating to each other and to the land as stewards. I'd love to hear you speak a bit how the work you've been doing is very much in service to those outcomes.
Thank you, Celine. Well, the grasslands of the world, which was our strategic entry point to work with people of the land and on the land, are vast landscapes, and they are not too charismatic in the eyes of the public. And like rainforests could be, for example, it seems that they are, you know, grass out there.
They're mysterious and full of wild animals.
The rainforests are,
yes.
Or the oceans, you know,
right.
Mysterious. But the grasslands is like these open spaces with nothing when you don't look closely. And in many cases, those are tied to deep cultures, pastureless cultures, and that only derive their livelihoods and their food from livestock. And these landscapes degraded very lot, it's around 75% of them by the FAO are known to be heavily degraded, what we call desertification, the loss of biological diversity in these places. And that started with the killing of the large herds of herbivores that maintain the wholeness of those environments. And then those were replaced with sedentary livestock that were not managed, mimicking nature. And so it created a lot of, you know, unraveling of the ecosystem processes and the simplification of the natural life.
The complexity,
exactly.
Yeah.
And as a result, they became less productive, less resilient, more prone to experiencing droughts and floods, and that impacts the livelihood and the economic viability of anything that is done on those places. So we have the honor of working with pastoral communities around the world, from Kenya to Patagonia to Australia to the Western United States. And each context is so different, culturally, socially, politically, environmentally, ecologically, because grasslands also are very varied around the world. And so there's no top-down solution. So what you go is you work with the people in those areas. We do that. We work with the people. because people are managing. So if people don't see it, if people don't own it, if people don't love what they are, and they don't see why they should do things differently, nothing happens. It's a commitment towards a vision that is better than what is happening now. So historically for us, people came to us when they were in financial stress, when they were about to lose their farm, when they had to leave communal lands because the land couldn't sustain them any longer. But so it was more, they were moving away from pain. But in the last few years, and I would say, I think 2015 was crucial when the 4 per 1,000 and the soil campaigns tied to the Paris Agreement happened. There was like an awakening. Not that there were a lot of people that were not already understanding these issues of the importance of the health of the soil, but suddenly, internationally and politically and from a business point of view, everybody saw the connection of healthy soils, climate change, economic resiliency, and so more conversations started at that point. And so it made it easier for us because now we have a lot of people coming to say, we want to design with those principles in mind, and we want to learn how to manage for complexity, which is all holistic management is. And so we're having a lot of young people that want to be a force of change. Women and young men as well, but a lot of women saying, we want to be part of creating that more beautiful world, as Charles Hanson said, say that we know is possible. And we're willing to put what it takes. So let's see, how do we design for something that is more, that honors and celebrates that complexity that we need to bring about? So working with people is key, and people need to be in that state of understanding. And that has been accelerated, I think, a lot since 2015.
Well, that's good to hear. Yes. That you are seeing an acceleration, because from what one can really read out there in terms of what is being said about what is the length of the runway that human beings have in order to do very deep systemic shifts in order to, as one of our colleagues says, you know, extend the runway, but moreover, actually start to do the deep restorational healing to all of the things on this planet that we have really behaved as though there was no consequence. And that, I think, is really interesting when we get into the terminology and the idea of regeneration, because regeneration is a principle-based orientation, much like holistic land management. I love that you said, you know, it's managing, designing for complexity. And I think we humans are uncomfortable often with that, and we want to simplify and reduce and partition and compartmentalize because we're just more comfortable with that. But it's like in direct violation of this extraordinary living planet of which we are one part.
One part. That's true.
So you mentioned that a lot of women are showing up, and I'm very interested to hear more about that, and also the younger generations that are showing interest in getting back on the land and building their livelihood there, but also doing healing to place.
Yes. I think a lot of young people realize the way it was is not what they want anymore. They are less about the material accumulation, the 9-to-5 jobs, you know, you read the trends, but there's this ache to reconnect. And in some cases it's becoming a rancher, in some cases it's volunteering at a place that brings them closer to understanding what are the things that need to change and how can I be part of it. And there are people that cannot have, I mean, in Boulder you have, you know, a lot of open space, and there's a lot of hiking and biking, but people want to engage in more meaningful ways. The COVID-19 crisis put very clearly how important it would be to have local food sources that I can reach out and have. And here they are very abundant in Boulder, but in other places we know they are not. So people are looking to, what, how can I grow my own veggies? How can I have my own chickens? And And in doing that, they start understanding the amount of real work and knowledge and skill and dedication and stewardship that it takes just to raise a little bit of your food, if not all, right?
Quite true.
And that elevates the farmer as an artisan, as a steward, as our hero, as, you know, the one that is doing all these things. But all we do as farmers and ranchers, and I am one, is look at what the market is. I mean, I cannot produce something that then I offer and people don't know what the difference is with what it is. So you will buy the cheaper option, or, I mean, not necessarily that being regenerative needs to be more expensive. That's a whole we'll get there. But to be able to, even if you cannot do it yourself, grow your own food, be able to go to a place and understand, well, you know, this piece of meat or chicken or veggie, it's not the veggie, it's not the meat, is how it was grown.
Right.
Was it grown regenerating soils, regenerating biological diversity in very complex communities, and honoring the farmer? Elevating the farmer, a farmer that gets paid fairly, because it's all about mutualistic relationships.
Right.
I get something that is good for my health, that nourishes me. I am investing, like we were talking before, in making sure that continues.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's also something here about story.
Mm.
Because what I hear you really alluding to is that it's the story of our food, it's the story of our land, and it's the story of the people who are there touching that food, that land, that soil, that we need to know a lot more about and appreciate in a whole new way. You know, because if you look at the amount of money in the whole supply chain, people are used to that term, I like to use web, or, you know, it's a relationship space. But the farmer gets the tiniest piece of that entire slip, you know, of that pie. And it really is very out of whack. It's not providing value where value is being given. And that is something that we need to do some deep soul searching around. Because if we as humans say, I want nutrient dense food, I want clean air, I want clean water, I want the land to thrive, well then, guess what? It's those people that are that touch point on the land that we need to be giving much more consideration to.
Yes.
And you work, as we said already, all over the world. You're in countries that are far less financially abundant than our privileged state in the United States. So how's that juxtaposed, you know, to what we're talking about just now about access to local food, resilience, but what is that like in an African culture, or in South American cultures, or in Australia or New Zealand? What can you say a little bit about those different touch points and what you see
happening?
Yeah.
Yes. And then I will also answer about the women, but
yes.
I didn't get to. but yes, there are differences because the contexts are so different. The culture, the gender, the ethnicity, you know, in agriculture, the economic, you know, situation, financial, political, and all kinds of differences. I think the more poor societies, the subsistence agriculture, they are all very much more in touch with that because they all grow their food to eat in the community.
Mm-hmm.
The food doesn't leave the farm to go feed somewhere else
right.
in the city.
Right.
The moment it becomes a business and what you do has to go through the supply chain, I like to go to the value network. I like the idea of the value. But it's not just supply. It's supply and it's demand and there is a relationship, right? So in that value exchange that happens among all the nodes that are part of that value network or web, there has to be a clear fairness there. Clear mutualism, as Rakates puts it. And it happens in smaller subsistence agriculture. It tends to be more clear, more
it's
transparent.
Like native to their reality. I mean, that's you
said. Give you the cow, you give me beans or whatever.
I'll trade you some milk for some beans.
And it has to feel fair
right.
and real.
Right.
Because otherwise, they wouldn't do it or they get mad at each other or whatever. But when it comes to a place in which it's produced, leaves the farm, and it goes through so many things we don't know. It's a big black box. At the other end, it comes in the same shape that the one next door.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's ways, and certifications have allowed us to have more information and ingredients and all those things. But getting information to the consumer to say, what am I investing in? What am I voting for when I buy these versus something else? And I think consumers are becoming, these young people are becoming a lot more curious, and they want to see, they want to understand better where they are putting their money. And so that's the work we're doing with the Land to Market program, in which part of holistic management is about measuring and observing and monitoring what's happening as we manage the land, what happened to the land, what happened to our financial, to our quality of life. And then when things start veering off, we adjust. We don't let it go all the way. So the importance of monitoring and early warning monitoring, what we can call leading indicators, are very important from a management point of view. And then now the marketplace is more find value in the what we call the lagging indicators, the water and the carbon being the ones that now are
very in vogue.
In vogue. You know, how much carbon did you sequester? Well, carbon means that there's roots and then there's tons of plants and then there are microbes and there's all this life that you have to allow to emerge via your interventions, via management.
Right.
Right? In some places in the world, you leave it and it works, like the rainforest. You leave it alone, it will do it because you have all that moisture year-round that does it. But if you have a farm or if you have a ranch and if you have animals, then you need to create that good, effective functioning of all these ecosystem processes.
Right.
With you being part of that.
Right. You have to have an oversight relationship. You have to have a plan of how you're going to move the animals around your land, what's being planted and why.
And with what behavior,
mm-hmm.
what are you trying to create? What are considerations that you need to take into account? Are there species of concern? We work a lot with the Nature Conservancy, prairie chickens. How do we make sure that at the times that we need to create certain conditions for them, they have them for their legs and for their, you know, chicks and whatever. And so we don't put the animals there at that time. And what are areas in which we really need to take a lot of the biomass, because otherwise we have potential fires. Or so there's a lot of thinking and understanding, first of what I have, for which we go and find out, make friends with your extension agencies and with the nature conservancies and those who may teach you what is in your piece of land if you don't know it,
mm-hmm.
if you're a new farmer. And then what do you need to do and put into your management so then you can move your animals to be in the right place, we always say, at the right time, for the right duration, with the right behavior. That doesn't mean that you're always going to punch them and move them around. It's very thoughtful because you're trying to honor and foster that complexity.
Mm.
And then complex systems are, you know, are self-organizing, so you never know what's going to happen, really. You want to believe, but you don't know. So that's where the monitoring and the, okay, continuing to asking the questions and moving.
Because you would obviously have to continue to adjust and
yes.
learn
yes.
and evolve
yes.
with the landscape, because as it starts to respond to what is being done, it's also going to change.
Yes.
So therefore, you have to be nimble and agile.
Yes.
Which, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm like, wow, that is a lot of work.
Yes.
And when I think about my idea of ranching and what I see out here in the West, it looks like people just kind of let them out in the field and
some may.
And you're
yes.
done. So
and some may.
And some may, and I think a lot do. I mean, we know that there's a lot of degradation, especially to lands managed by the federal government that are horribly degraded, because that's pretty much what's happened. Mm-hmm. Cattle are just left to their own devices. There is no oversight and management except to collect them for
Yeah, and there's slaughter. So little capacity at the government level to go and sort of like go and help or even audit. But what you do when you manage holistically and you want to understand that complexity and bring it into the management, you reach out to those folks in your BLM office, let's say, and you have conversations. And if what you propose is better than what they can imagine would happen otherwise, they are very good at giving you the opportunity to learn together.
That's
so
great.
I think, again, it's part of that those relationships, you know, that you can have with your BLM guy, if you have public lands, with your manager, if you're the owner and you're not hands-on, like in a lot of parts of the world, the owner is not necessarily the manager, with your providers, then the animals need to adjust to new management too. The land adjusts, you adjust. I mean, and all that you have to do in a way that allows you to put, you know, to pay your checks, to pay your bills monthly. So there's tremendous amount of complexity on a farm. And so the beauty would be to understand how it's done. I like it. You've measured. You're regenerating. I want to buy it. The problem comes when that differentiated product leaves the gate and enters a system that is undifferentiated and that puts volumes and efficiencies priority.
Absolutely.
So that's also what we need to shift. But if someone, a consumer, can see, okay, I want to support that farmer, so I'm going to buy from them, even if they are not local, although that would be awesome, but even if I'm buying a piece of meat from White Oak Pastures in Georgia, I know that I'm contributing to something really beautiful there.
I just sent my dad, as for his gift, from White Oak Pastures.
Yeah, girl.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it, because he's in Tennessee, so it's almost local.
Yes.
It's regional.
Yes.
It's a regional thing.
Yes, and White Oak Pastures is one of the savory hubs in the savory network that is just fantastic.
Right, and yeah. Will Harris is
the rock star.
The rock star farmer who we all love and adore for his incredible transformation.
Yeah.
And then all that has unfolded on that farm. And I mean, it is a really powerful example of when you decide that you're going to embrace this, it's like nature and everything else says yahoo, and it works with you. And that's what I think is also so exciting, Daniela, is that, you know, something we tend to forget is how powerful and resilient life is. And that if we start to provide some generousness and love, we get back so much. And that for me is like the thing that gives me the most sense of our deep capacity to make these changes and find ourselves met by this living earth and its desire to be in a state of abundance.
Yes.
And it's like if you've ever seen the tenacious little plant growing in the crack in the concrete, you see it. It's like, wow, life is tenacious. And so there's a lot to work with.
Yes. And to go back to your women piece of your question, I don't know if it's, you know, when you have an idea, all those ideas are already sprouting around the world, you know, that Elizabeth Gilbert wrote, and also, or you're just paying attention at something that before you were not paying attention and now you start seeing it. But a few years back, what I started realizing is that women have a set of characteristics that makes them really fit for the regeneration movement. Part of it has to do with that nurturing, you know, and without being stereotypical, there are a lot of men that have that too, but nurturing, long view, and I think that's the way we evolve. Long and wide and nurturing and a lot of moral courage. I just have seen women, and in many of the cultures in which we operate, we see that the women, the voice of the women is always behind the man, but they are the ones informing action. And when we started saying, okay, let's bring a little bit these voices that have been more silent, culturally speaking, in a way, with all their feminine power back into the table, all these women networks started popping up. I'm so excited. There's one in Uruguay that started, you know, a couple of years ago just by virtue of a meeting we had. And I put these beautiful women and we were filming them, you know, to this one. And we asked questions, why so important to you? And it was so moving that the gentleman that was sort of participating there too, but he's part of the Institute for Natural Meat in Uruguay, got so inspired that he said, I'm going to finance a gathering of the women in regenerative in Uruguay. The next thing you know, we have 100 women connected by WhatsApp. In part, some of them are politicians, they work in the government, some of them are farmers, some of them are small farmers, some of them are journalists, and they are all helping each other move this regenerative voice in Uruguay, and they are loud. They're going to change things. Same, there was one, I was in Spain with Alan Savory, with our hub there, meet this woman, she's forming this amazing group of women, Pleiades, that you and I are part of.
Mm.
That is awesome. Women in ranching, all these women understanding that together we may be able to put that intelligence, that energy into the system. So I'm excited and I want to be part of all of them.
Because of course.
I know, because they are so inspiring and really empowering.
Well, you know, we did a Women on the Land program together, yes, and we're going to be doing this again in July. And I agree with you. I mean, I noticed that a lot of the leaders around the world who are really beating the drum and activating engagement are women. And, you know, I'm excited about that.
Me too.
I think women have been haven't held a primary seat at the table for a long, long, long time. And I think part of this deeper shift that's toward a more healthy, balanced ecosystem, it also is the biodiversity of we as people. And this whole thing going on with Black Lives Matter is also an expression of this, we must reckon with the imbalances. And the imbalances are expressed in whose voices have the most authority, whose ideas gain the most traction, who's silenced, who's never listened to at all, who has to, you know, jump up and down and wave their arms madly to get heard. That has to change, because it's just like our watching this mass extinction on our planet. It's all of one fabric, and its underpinning is a bad idea, which is separation.
Mm-hmm.
There is no separation.
Yes.
But that myth that has instantiated itself throughout, you know, kind of the Renaissance and in religious iconography and in those stories that people have
told
is like we're separate from, and then we're separate from each other, and then we've created
separate from nature.
Sexist, you know, gender separation. So we have created this extraordinary hierarchical story that's deeply false.
Yeah.
It does not reflect anything in our living systems around us. There is nothing in the world that would say back to us, that's the way to do it.
Yeah. And it's so ingrained in our evolution, you know, the roles and functions of men in the hand, short term, you know, die or kill was the, and we were, you know, in the cave, keeping the fire.
Well, see, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, because, I mean, really what is more likely is that there wasn't a hierarchy. There was an acknowledgement of the roles,
mm-hmm,
of who was best suited to do what. And it wasn't a value proposition that made you better than me. That I think for those bands of humans to succeed, everyone had a role to play, exactly. And those were valued.
Yes.
Equally.
My point. Yes.
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 So I think we lost that, and you know, there's some excellent books out there. If someone listening to this is like, I'm interested, Sapiens.
Yes.
Is fantastic. A fabulous book. Mm-hmm. That does an incredible walk through the journey of what we can ascertain, because we can't ever know for sure.
That's right.
And then what we can know a lot more about is the agricultural revolution, mm-hmm. and how, you know, we basically became enslaved, sorry to use that word, but to the wheat plant and to propagate this grass all over the world. And we it became our master.
It is the,
And then interestingly,
the beginning of degradation.
Yes, the beginning of degradation. And so obviously it's a lot to untangle.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and this is something I think I would like for us to play with, is if we could get ourselves excited about what is potentialized, what's the possibility, and go stand in that field and feel it, sense it, really take it in, that just extraordinary, I'm getting chills as I'm saying this, that incredible abundance.
Yes.
Surrounding us.
Yes.
And that, so then what are the steps that we have to take to make sure we get there?
Yes. I love that you bring this up. I am working with a group, it's an international group, and they are teaching us the Merlin method. And it is about that. It's about working rather than from the past to project the future, working from the future, remembering the past, and understanding what are commitments that need to happen between the reality of the future, the possibility of the future, and today, to make sure it happens, you know. So what happened? And so we start remembering what happened, and it's a completely different mindset than if you look back and say, well, we were able to do that, how do we change it? We say, this is the expression of the future we want to live in 20, 30, 20, 50, whatever that might be. So what has happened? What were the commitments? What were the changes? And changes and action comes from commitments in conversations. So.
And we like commitments.
We
don't
like
we,
commitments,
darling?
Totally. Commitments are the, as I heard, the ones that commitments are the seed of action. And that is, I think, very important in the regenerative conversations today, as we talk about it in policy, we talk about regeneration investment, we talk about regeneration market. You know, settings, we talk about regeneration in education, we talk about regeneration on the land. And you, in finance, yeah, I said investors, right? Did I mention that? So there's all these layers or nodes, right?
Yeah.
That are part of the regenerative movement, and there's a lot of conversations. And I want to start now because, like we were talking before, those conversations are needed to understand, to then deeply own, and then it's time now, I think, that we start putting commitments on the table that are actionable and that the farmers don't get left out of those commitments, right? Because it's about making sure that ultimately we're relating to land and growing our food and fiber in ways that sustain us and not in ways that breaks us apart. So very exciting times. We're seeing it with our land market program, the amount of brands, big and small, that want to be part of co-creating this with us globally. Some really nice conversations and some commitments. The investment world, we're seeing it still trying to sort out how it's going to be done. We see a lot more philanthropic money being put into activating opportunities for then investment money to come in, but not at the speed and the size that I would like to. A lot of it is still very speculative, I think. But when we truly commit to that future, we will realize that we have to do it. And if we have to do it and we do it, we will all win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're listening to Regenerative Voices, Activating Stories, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm Celine Diaris, your host from At the Epicenter, and with me is Daniela Ibarra-Howell, co-founder and CEO of the Savory Institute. Let's go back to this notion around commitment, because I think we have been noticing that people have spent a lot of time on why. You know, why should we do things differently? Why are these outcomes so detrimental? And why are the systems that we have problematic? It's the how, which is now, it's the how that is the really this the significance of the now. And how do we start to make the why shift into a much more explicit clarity of what we each need to be making commitments to?
Yeah.
And with that, I want to throw in an idea that I have to say I heard from you and I love, is the notion of we are investors. And I'm not a big fan of the word consumer. I like using the word citizen because it's a more responsible, accountable way to frame and think of ourselves, because we are. We're citizens of our respective nations. We're citizens on this planet. And we are the economy. The economy is a reflection of what we do with our hard-earned incomes. And we've talked about vote with your dollar, but there's something not powerful enough about that to me. But if you remind us that we are in fact investors, that trillions and trillions of dollars in the economy is coming from us, the people, we the people.
Yes.
Therefore, if we want to step into that future point, that field, and we want to figure out how we got there, then part of what that looks like is what we are investing in our choices.
Yes.
You know, this is a used Eileen Fisher top.
It's
this
one is, of our partners.
Yes,
partners.
I know. Which is why I brought
Thank
her
you,
up.
Eileen Fisher.
So she has that whole, you know, renewal
Yes.
piece in her business. So try aligning ourselves.
Yes.
And to think of it as I'm investing in grass-fed beef. Yes, I'll spend more for that hamburger or that beef, but I don't need as much meat as I may think I need, but I am going to put it where it's going to make the biggest impact and difference.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about this framing and helping us start to take on the mantle of being investors.
Because
we tend to think of investors as people with lots and lots and lots of money.
Yep.
But
that is not.
It's not true.
And you see it sometimes clearly when you have, when something happens in your life, either you have kids or you get sick, and you look for, okay, I'm going to invest more in their health or in my health. You look at it as an investment. And so, in a way, you're investing in the system that brings about in return, because it comes in. I like first to talk about return on investment in many different currencies. We need to stop talking, you know, about return on investment only in financial currencies, and the rest is externalities. Not everything lives with us, and we are all inheriting that. So we may invest in a poorly designed extractive system that feeds us something that makes us sick. Then we have to invest in a pharmaceutical system. We're investing, we're saying we want you to continue to live to cure me from what the food
and
has
you don't
been.
Really ever cure me you
and
just
you never cure
treat
me
my
symptoms. Exactly. Or do we want to invest more in a system that is whole, and like Zach Bush calls, Dr. Zach Bush, you know, that you really feed, you know, health and is medicine, food is medicine, then I don't have to invest in a pharmaceutical system. And, you know, and to tell you the truth, when I need pharmaceutical you know, an Advil, whatever, you go there. But again, it's a shift in mindset in what are the things I'm putting my money, and a lot of that in America, at least, or proportionally a lot of it worldwide, that goes into food, into sustaining our, my husband says, in maintaining our 98.6 degrees. You know, that's what we do. We just find the niches to keep us at 98.6, to keep us alive.
Yeah, food is like food. 14% of that, you know, 70% of our activity in the world is in food. Food is huge. I mean, you know, housing and transportation. Well, it should be more, because we've also become addicted to the idea that food should be cheap.
Cheap, exactly.
And we've kind of gotten what we asked for.
Yeah.
And so we have the highest rates of diabetes,
yes,
and obesity,
yes,
and all these inflammatory diseases,
yes,
and all of these endocrine disrupting illnesses that are all connected to a chemical intensive agricultural,
yes,
system.
Yes.
And there's so much evidentiary material out there that demonstrates the absolute connection. And yet, just like with cigarettes, we continue to debate this.
Yes.
And the system continues to propagate itself on the backs of us. And it's kind of like, at some point, I'm hoping that where we are now collectively, there may be enough will developing in our collective guts to say enough.
Enough. Charles Einstein talked to us the other day, and we were saying, how do we, you know, the system is like this rock, right? And how do, you know, we've been feeling that we've been chipping away, and do we build a different model? And I said, well, you have been hollowing away. So you still think it's strong, but maybe it's really shallow, and any stress, like a COVID, can break it all apart. And
right,
then what will emerge from that, and to be ready to emerge something more beautiful? But yeah, we invest 15%, 17%, but how much trillions of dollars go into health, like you were saying? Or trillions of dollars are spent in natural resource, failure.
So degradation.
Right, repairing degradation of or insurance for, floods or droughts. So a lot of the symptoms of environmental malfunction tied to land degradation, the fires, look at the fires, the massive fires cost us tremendous amount. And that all that is the lack of proper management of our natural resources. So if we start shifting, where do we put the money in fixing the symptom, or do we truly try to understand what would human management and design and policy and market alignment to allow us to truly address the root cause and shift where we put our money to creating that more
exactly
ideal world.
I mean, I also like to say, for me, this is also a challenge to the imagination.
Yes.
And so you have the first defense that people come up with is like, well, jobs. And you've got these huge iconic companies that now have more money than countries, that we think there's no way we can exist without the DuPonts and the Syngentas and the Bayers and et cetera, et cetera. All of these extraordinarily big international corporations. And so to reimagine, like, it's not to do damage, but it's to realign and shift, because I'm sure that the incredible creativity of the humanity within those enterprises could absolutely shift their attention and creative force to doing deep reparation and repair and cleanup and coming up with new things that are actually deeply helpful to the human community and the living planet, to go into a state of deep regeneration and renewal. So I think it's a constraint on imagination that is often the biggest obstacle for us to overcome, because I don't think it necessarily equates, you know, just pandemonium and a horrible outcome for all of these players.
No.
I just don't think that's...
No, maybe they know they've been hollowed. You know, using Charles' analogy again. They know it's coming. And they are maybe trying to reinvent themselves. And the moment it crashes, something will come out of that. I think we're all realizing. Bigfoot is realizing. They're trying to learn from us, coming closer to us. You know, how can we change those things? But there's a lot of interest in maintaining the status quo. But at some time, probably that will have to give to something else. One thing that I find quite telling is a matter of courage or a matter of risk-taking, the amount of money, and probably institutional money or corporate money, that is going into research to see if regenerative works, when we know regenerative works, right? So, and I asked one of our science advisors why so much money is put in science when we know it works. There is already, you see it, smell it, and there is science on top of that. But why there's that risk aversion to put the money in management, to put the management in systems change rather than in more research? And it happened here locally as well. And he said, you know, it's tough. They need to it's that sense of an institution needs to make sure it doesn't do the wrong thing because there's a name to protect. So better to have more information. And we're spending a lot of money, in many cases it's tax money, in many cases it's corporate money, to convince of something or to say that we're super sure, when the science cannot even tell you that, because you don't know all these, you know, emerging properties of regenerative systems. You don't know how amazing the potential could be. And what are we measuring? Are we really measuring something that points to that potential? It's just invested in doing it. But to get to that point, I think humans need to get to a level of comfort or have a hit like COVID or have something that gets you, you know, we have to do it.
Well, I love that you brought up measurement because it's something that I just recently stuck my neck out there in the world and said a few things. But the World Resource Institute came out with a report that pretty much tried to disavow claims around the carbon sequestration capacity of agriculture as part of the climate mitigation strategy. And then there was a very powerful rebuttal. And so here we are in this tug of war, will it, own it, blah, 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 which is right back to what you were saying. And my frustration with all of this is that this is a way to equivocate and not act and not make commitments to do real things, to make real change. So we dither when we dither and we dither until it's too late. And we're not far away from a too late place where the amount of disruption in weather patterns are so drastic that what we are trying to do in land restoration just can't take hold because the rains don't come, or the rains come with a vengeance. And so there is a point where we can't actually take on the type of transformation that is quickly leaving our ability to attend to.
Yep.
And so I'm interested in how do we, Daniela, how do we help move the conversation away from this hyper data orientation to honoring the human capacity to witness and observe and reason and see that this improved. We can trust that this is replicable.
Yeah.
And therefore, why not?
Yeah.
And what is, in your experience, because you talk to a lot of people, you know, how can we circumvent or circumnavigate so that we can get really fundamental commitments starting to take root for real?
Yeah.
And move this forward with deep commitment and alacrity because we do not have time on our side.
Yeah. Well, our model for that to happen is measurements need to be done by those managing the land. So we are empowering the same farmers and the community, our hubs, the communities that serve and support implementation of those farmers and ranchers to measure those leading indicators. It's very observational. It's like what you're saying, you know, I see what's happening, less bare ground, more plants are establishing, it smells better, all the things that we need, and we take note. And we do it in a way that meets scientific rigor, but it's not expensive, so it's replicable, and each farmer can do it, and each group of farmers can do it. Then come the whole experiment of how do we, if all the leading indicators are moving in the right direction, there's obviously the lagging indicators will be also trending in that direction. So we can say that if all those are moving in the right direction in 5 years, when I measure carbon in ways that are not just so expensive that no one can do it, but in a way that someone can, you know, start, and that is very, today is very expensive and very inaccurate. So when you start correlating that with the leading indicators, you start having more robust sets of data that are easy, affordable, meaningful, inform management, and allow us to get to year five and find what we need to find. What I think a lot of the money spent is creating those measurement ideas, and I say we'll become so good at measuring degradation because nothing has been done on the land. Or in the case of a lot of universities, they are going and measuring in places that might or might not be regenerative or regenerating. And therefore, maybe some of those assessments come from, and I know that some folks have done it, come from very overrested, not well managed. It looks like it has a lot of biomass, but it's not really acting and doing
their thing. It's not diverse, complex.
It's not photosynthesizing, it's not, because it's not being managed properly. And they are putting, and they are not seeing much, or the methods are very inaccurate still. So you have to put so many samples and everything that it becomes impossibly expensive.
Well, and I think this is what my concern is. By attaching our value proposition so strongly to carbon and making carbon the enemy, we're carbon-based life, so carbon is what is a beautiful aspect of life on Earth. It's just that carbon is
displaced. In,
right, it's displaced. So really the opportunity is how do we restore balance? And we have a lot of ways, to your point, that we can start to observe it with our own naked eyes, that we can look for the bioactivity below the ground while we witness what's happening above the ground. And nature is the greatest teacher of all. And if we had a little less hubris and a little more humility and sat back with a bit more of a beginner's mind and said, wow, there's a lot of intelligence all around us, and we could learn by observing and start to mimic what nature has always done effectively and get out of our own way and stop making yet another sort of highly monetized notion of what we have to have before we act.
Yeah.
I think this is highly problematic.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to need to push back rather strongly on, you know, carbon is, that's like a misappropriation mm-hmm. of attention. Mm-hmm. And really we should be looking on the bioactivity, mm-hmm. the life, mm. life in the ground, life above the ground. Life is our goal.
Yes.
Abundant life, biodiversity. Yeah. That's that field that I want to be standing in out there.
Yes.
And to get to her abundance and beauty is far less attached to probing the ground and monitoring from the heavens.
Yeah.
There's a lot we
biologically
can do.
You know that if that is the condition, you'll be sequestering carbon via all these.
Precise.
That's right.
Exactly.
So you know it. How much? For how long? Okay,
at the end,
a second conversation to be had. There's a lot of really cool scientists. Some of them are in our advisory board. I could mention them, but then I would leave some out, and so I don't want to, but pioneers in saying, let's look at where there is regeneration going and let's learn from there. And then let's try to find very strong correlations between carbon, which is the obsession. And water, which will be probably our next big concern, if not already.
Yes.
And then the loss of biological, or the regaining or reestablishing of biological diversity above and below ground. And how the soils are so much more able to deal with changes in weather and making the farm and food production more resilient. And they are wanting to go there. So I'm super grateful to these researchers and the organization, the institutions that they represent. So hopefully research will start shifting into more relevant and supportive of that vision of yours and mine, of course, as well. So
our
vision. And so hopefully that will start happening. But I think we need to start deploying more into the capacity building and the change, rather than continuing, you know, putting all the money in the safe place of research, especially, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be, you know, at the Epicenter is going to be launching a new project, and we're talking to a lot of our colleagues, including you, calling it Regenerative Rising. But it's really, how do we rebuild? What are the multi-sectored alliances? How do we come together, start to be deeply strategic in what we're going to implement? And as you said in the beginning of this, what are those commitments? And let's lock arms and get her done.
Yes. And I think we have to, we mentioned it before too, design different distribution, processing and distribution, and elevate them too from this dark box that in which there's a lot of social issues, and we've seen them through COVID. And it's like these cogs on a machine rather than these people that could be artisans, a meat processor. When he or she's an artisan, it's a beautiful skill that we all should know how it, because it brings us closer to the food and honoring the food
and the animal
and the animal and their life and their lives. Yes. and how it was raised, and then the shorten that long supply chain, and then the relationship is between that artisan and the steward and the investor as
the eater,
citizen, as the eater, an educator in our brands, have true educators in our brands. They have huge megaphones. They can tell a lie or they can tell the truth.
Right.
And then we'll have the right information to make the decision. Do we go for the Cheerios full of, you know, sugar, whatever, or do we go for the grass-fed milk or whatever that might be?
Right.
Because now we know better. So they have a tremendous responsibility at this point in time to inform the people they serve.
Absolutely. And I want to, the plant versus meat world, those kind of clashes. I really want to just also add that it's not the cow, it's the how.
So the mama cows are always the factory, the herd, the mama herd is always on the land. And they have their calves. And the calves may go into someone else to start, you know, or feeding them and finishing them quicker. Or they may stay a year on the land and then go to a feedlot. Usually they spend in a feedlot, they spend, I think it's 150 days, so like 3-4 months of their life, during which they are fed a lot of grain and that upset their stomachs. They're designed to process cellulose, so you know that's when the antibiotics came, and so that's why they cannot be there. But that has brought the speed, the efficiency, and the unified nature of flavor and consistency, which was what the citizen asked for or what got used to. Now in Argentina they are studying that, and they think it's better. Oh my goodness, we have a culture of grass fed that is falling apart because of these machines telling, oh, look how good, look at how tender, look at, and that's not how it's supposed to, but it's what is used, right? So, and people that run feedlots are very concerned about, you know, the health of the animal and everything, but something is happening there that shouldn't be happening. But also on the land, we have the ability to shift how those are managed. Because, yes, they are eating grass, and that's their natural instinct. But depending how they are managed, they could be degrading the land, and there's all this carbon from the soil that goes into the atmosphere, or they could be regenerating. So there's two areas in which we need to think. The feedlot brings cropland, monocrops, so there's problems there, there's problems of animal welfare, and there's problems of waste management. And all that should be on the land. And it doesn't really take, it takes more time, but it doesn't necessarily take more land. We made a study that 30% increase in stocking rates, 30%, just a little bit of a stocking rate increase, without converting the croplands that go into feedlots, we do it. And we know with holistic management, we double. We go 100% stocking rate. That's a brand promise.
So I don't know what those terms mean, stocking rate. So
yeah, the amount of cows that could be in a certain ranch.
Yes.
So according to their carrying
capacity.
So
100 head of cattle versus 200 head of cattle.
That's right. So if these animals were going to stay there until they are finished, you would have more animals on the land because they didn't go to the feedlot. So in the United States, without even touching those croplands, it would increase the amount of animals where there are already animals. The babies would stay with their parents, or they would go somewhere where they can be finished. It would mean a 30% increase of animals on the land. And again, because overgrazing and degradation is not tied to numbers, it's tied to management. When we manage properly and holistically, we can go 100% or 200% more animals that are not a liability. They're not producing waste. They are really recycling all those beautiful, you know, ecosystem processes, making them strong, making more biological diversity, making them photosynthesize more, feeding the land. So if properly done and properly, you know, managed, there's no need, if we had a different business model, there's no need for feedlots.
Well, that's cool. And I think it's important to recognize that both agricultural row crop practice does a lot of degradation.
Yes.
As does the way animals are currently put into confined management, and that it's what we're really talking about is liberating animals and reintegrating them into farms. And there's some powerful examples of polyculture farms that have, you know, the ducks and the chickens and the hogs and the cows, and they're all moving through that landscape. And what happens is that everything rises in its productivity and its life, and the wildlife comes back, and the wild raptors come back. And it is, if we could take ourselves back a moment and consider what this planet looked like before we really started to tinker with it so much. It was a highly integrated diversity of life in every part of this planet. And it has, that's what it wants to be. And that's when it thrives, and we will thrive with it. So we'll end there as a shared thriving. But I want to give you a final comment.
Well, so I'll use it to thank you for your work of bringing the conversations that need to be had among us, and to inform and hopefully inspire others to have their conversations, and hopefully there will be commitments along the way that will move us to that more beautiful world we know is possible, according to Charles Einstein. So.
Well, it's a world according to a lot of us. So
a lot of us.
He does a beautiful job of pointing it out, but I think what's true is it is truth, and truth is very liberating. And so what I'm hoping is that as we all do the parts that we do in this large tapestry, that it will get stronger and stronger, and the attraction of the wider community to add its thread into this tapestry of renewing and replenishing the life that we are all intimately interwoven with will become a song in our hearts.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And for that to happen, the relationships, it's all human relationships, it's learning. Brené Brown says it's hard to hate up close. Let's get closer to those who we don't know. Let's learn from each other and let's co-design that world.
With our 6 feet of social distance.
At this moment, please.
At this moment.
I'm wearing mine. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniela. You've been listening to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm Celine Diarras, and this is Daniela Ibarra-Howell, co-founder and CEO of the Savory Institute. Thank you for listening.
The Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.